Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 28, Fakaro, to decide. Notes from CWB. I think I mentioned this in the last chapter, but it's worth reiterating as it applies to this chapter too. When I first started this, I wasn't completely sure what a juvenile Emperor Pang looked like. I gave John his colored underbill stripe as a point of contrast to Sherlock, who hadn't physically matured as much as John at that point. Now, hours and hours and hours of research later, I know that Emperor Penguins don't get their adult markings until about their first birthday, so the physical description in this chapter is accurate. Sherlock stands on the ledge and looks for a way around the obstacle in his way. Ice. So much ice on this stupid iceberg, he thinks to himself. He could try to climb over the protuberance, but if he slips, if he falls, he's done for. Frustrating as it is, he's going to have to retreat and try to ascend from a different angle. He's been up all night, having snuck away from the crush as soon as everyone was asleep. The moon is round and bright. The sky is free of clouds. Whether or not the heavens had cooperated, he would have done it tonight. He has no more time. His father and others on their way home to Pobeda will arrive tomorrow. He and John have to make a decision, but before they do that, Sherlock needs to gather more information. He needs to know what Marengo is up to, if anything, that she fell from high enough to hurt her leg as badly as she did. He turns with as much regard for the slippery path beneath him as he can and retreats toward the last turning point in the path. He has explored as much of Cassiopeia as he can, one nook and cranny at a time. If he couldn't find a way to continue, he figured that no one else would be able to either, and rules that part of the berg out of consideration. He hasn't found a thing, but the pinnacle of the mountain remains unexplored, still out of reach, perhaps forever unattainable. Far below him, John sleeps, unaware that he is now cuddling up to Malling instead of Sherlock. The sun will rise soon, and Sherlock's plan does not include being yelled at by one very pukukino John, not if he can help it. He told John that he would not go off in search of the Heartstone by himself, and he won't. But if John wakes and finds Sherlock missing, he might jump to the wrong conclusion. He'd be unhappy anyway to think that Sherlock was risking life and wing in the middle of the night to scale this formidable chunk of ice. When he reaches the place at which he last turned, he stops and looks around. The only way to go is back down, or to the ice cave, their ice cave. Certainly a fall from this height would cause injury, but why would Moringa keep coming back to the cave after taking everything out of it? Wagoa, who can say? He certainly can't predict anything about that crazy bird except the obvious. Her craziness makes her unpredictable. He decides he has enough time to check the ice cave and makes his way there more by touch memory than sight. He steps inside and stares, never having imagined this version of their secret place. The ice cave has captured the moonlight and is bouncing it around its walls, illuminating the space in sparkling blues and silvers, brighter than the longest summer day. The light ricochets between the stalactites above him before shooting it back down in dazzling lasers. He stands, staring, wishing that John could see what he is seeing. He imagines that standing on a star would be similar, all glitter and shine. A star. He spits the tooth out of his mouth and watches it skip across the floor of the cave. It is so bright, so glossy clear, Sherlock can see his reflection when he bends down to examine the tooth. He is caught off guard, not having seen more of himself than is possible in the ever-moving, dark, and blurry reflection of the sea. He takes a moment to look at himself, as he has often wondered what John sees when he looks at Sherlock. He's gained height over the summer, but he is not as full as John across the chest or belly. He is almost entirely crisp white, dark gray, and smooth black, having lost all of his soft gray chick fuzz. He's not gained the yellow plumage of adulthood, nor has his underbelly taken on its eventual stripe of vivid color. His eyes are slanted up more than John's, giving him a thoughtful, serious expression. Interesting, but ultimately not important. John likes him as he is. He turns back to the tooth lying at his feet. In the illumination of the cave, with its blue and silver cast, the tooth seems larger and the etching more precise. He prods it with his bill, hoping to see something new, something different.
"Do something already," he says. "Are you even real? Is there a heart stone? Or are you a plain, ordinary seal tooth? Interesting markings, purely coincidental. Maybe the legend grew from you. Maybe you inspired the story. Maybe the clouds inspired some of our stories, and the stars, and the constellations, and maybe it's just us, all alone, in this ice-covered corner of wherever we are. We never flew, never had a mare bestowed upon us or taken away."
Sherlock is depressing himself. He's standing in a cave talking to a tooth, and he sounds like a existential crisis waiting to happen. Well, maybe that's better than the alternative, he thinks, which so far is nothing. What did he expect, he wonders? Proof of Moringa's hidden secret plans? Instructions on use of the tooth? A map to the Heartstone? Some sign of what he's supposed to do? Ninikara, nonsense, all of it. If he's going to move forward, he's going to have to rely on what he actually knows and nothing more. What does he know? What information can he rely on right now to help inform his next step? He knows that he has the tooth. He knows the tooth is tied to a legend about a brother trying to save a sister and her family from ruin. He knows that maybe, or maybe not, whoever holds the tooth holds immense power. The power to what? To have whatever they want. He knows what he wants. He has what he wants. He will not risk that to go off on some fool's errand, chasing something that remains unknown and nebulous to him. Now, he asks himself, what does he believe? Does he believe that the legends are just that? Stories created by mortals to better understand the world in which they live, to answer the unanswerable? Yes, he believes that. Does he believe in the possibility that more than what he knows exists in this universe? Mysteries and secrets that affect him, although we cannot see them? Yes, he believes in that possibility too. What else does he believe? He believes in John. He believes in their love for each other. He believes he is good, and John is good, and most Pengs are good. He believes in the end, if he does the right things, lives the right way, doesn't hurt others, he will prevail over any obstacle thrown his way, as a Peng, and with John, and in the colony. He believes in the colony. He believes that the spirit of Amadere resides in each and every one of them, that it is a choice, and that they each must choose to be peaceful, kind, and generous, to look after the heart of the group, and not just the individual. The sun is throwing her first rays over the surface of the sea. Soon she will use those rays to pull herself up and over the horizon, and she will chase away the moon, and the prism of magic light in this ice cave will disappear. He feels desperate to be back with John now, to tell him that he's given it all a great deal of thought, and that he has decided absolutely nothing, because there's nothing to decide, because they already have each other. He stands up straight and looks around the cave again. Yes, it's beautiful, but no, there's nothing else here. He needs to go. He needs to get back to the creche before the sun does. Notes: Maori translations. Pukukino, grumpy, bad-tempered, angry, volatile, cantankerous, irritable, crabby. Waikahua. Who can say?